Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
And here we are for another week. It is John Pollock and Brandon Thurston coming to you from Toronto and the hotspot of Buffalo, New York. And someone we will be hearing from over the next hour is Jordan Goodman. He's going to be joining us. You may be familiar with him on the wellness policy here on Post Wrestling, and spent several years working in the front office at Ring of Honor. Of course, we got the news on Tuesday about Joe Koff's passing. So we'll be talking with Jordan about that era in particular of Ring of Honor that, you know, Joe Koff oversaw throughout the entire Sinclair run of Ring of Honor. So that is coming up. We also have other news and notes to get to. And we had yet another filing on Tuesday from Janelle Grant's team as they have made a filing of a memorandum in opposition to Carlin Kolker and Peak Wellness's motion to dismiss the bill of discovery, this battle over the electronic medical records, that we were actually able to get a response from Kolker's counsel that Brandon sought out. But before that, let's first of all, because we did get a press conference in connection with this, we'll hear from Ann Callis first, the lawyer from Janelle Grant, for Janelle Grant, explaining what this filing is and what they are seeking to dismiss.
Today, we submitted a new legal filing against Dr. Carlin Kolker, a physician of former WWE CEO Vince McMahon's payroll, and Peak Wellness, Inc., the medical clinic owned by Dr. Kolker. Due to the abuse she suffered, Janelle was desperate for medical help, and she trusted licensed professionals to approach her care with the utmost seriousness. Dr. Kolker instead violated ethical and medical standards and routinely broke the doctor-patient trust integral to proper treatment. When Janelle needed medical care due to Vince McMahon's sexual and emotional abuse, McMahon made her go to a clinic called Peak Wellness, where one of her abusers worked. She was receiving treatment there from November 2019 to April 2022 at the direction of McMahon. The abuser at the clinic was a physical therapist and a third person involved in an incident where McMahon defecated on Janelle's head and forced her to continue to engage in sexual acts with the Peak Wellness employee. At Peak Wellness, Dr. Kolker, who runs the clinic, also directed Janelle to take mystery pills daily and forced her to accept intravenous infusions of unknown contents. He is now wrongfully withholding Janelle's full personal medical records in violation of federal and state law. Janelle has been asking for those records and for the message history between Dr. Kolker and McMahon regarding Janelle since February. Dr. Kolker was on McMahon's payroll and obtained access to Janelle's private medical records, dictated her treatments, and often coerced Janelle into continuing her treatments at Peak Wellness.
So that was Ann Callis, again, the attorney for Janelle Grant. And this filing came on Tuesday. And I mean, it's sort of just reiterating like their desire to have this struck down, where Kolker and Peak Wellness have tried to end this bill of discovery. And Brandon, I know you've also been in contact with Dr. Kolker and Peak Wellness's counsel, who did have a response to this.
Yeah, only his lawyers. Who say that they have given them, that they have given the Grant side all the records that they want, including electronic records, but the Grant side is disputing that. They refer to on the press call having paper records that they're concerned could be manipulated in some way. This is a suit that, I don't know if we should call it a lawsuit, but it's definitely a petition. It's a case. It's a legal case that has been around since mid-July. We reported on it at the time. there's a PR team helping Janelle Grant now, and it was sort of presented as if this was a news story, and maybe they just feel that it hasn't gotten the attention that they wanted to get. But there was also another case that we don't have a lot of clarity on why it was dropped. Dr. Colker essentially filed his own separate petition against Janelle Grant for records, making it seem like he was preparing for a defamation suit, which has never happened, has never been filed yet. And he dropped that suddenly with little explanation from either side. We did ask, but that has gone away. But basically this was an expected legal response. The Colker side has moved to have this dismissed. The Grant side is now saying this is why it should not be dismissed. It will be for the judge to decide from here, I think. But this is one sort of sub story in the larger story of the case that she's making in January against W. E. Vince and Laurinaitis about sex trafficking, sexual assault. Just raising that, she was being directed, being made by Vince to go to this clinic where she was being given medicines, supplements. She doesn't know what they are. That's her side of the story.
Yeah, and it did state that Grant has filed a bill of discovery for the purposes of investigating potential claims of civil conspiracy, aiding and abetting, fraud, assault, battery, RICO, RICO conspiracy, and or breach of fiduciary duty against Dr. Colker and Peak Wellness, and is seeking the records and testimony that is relevant to the medical care provided to her by Colker and Peak Wellness at the direction of Vince McMahon. They had made the request for the electronic records. They are not disputing they have received some records from Peak Wellness, but have called them incomplete paper records that they have responded with, that they've called incomplete and inaccurate, that they have received so far, believing there is more. And the fact that it's still a mystery what medication she was given is still not clear. Like, you would think that would be a baseline level of information that would be provided. Like, that part to me stands out, that if she still to this day does not know the medication she was given, that to me would be a pretty clear item that you would be disclosing.
No, we haven't seen whatever Dr. Kogler says he's given them. We haven't seen those records. I've given that they're medical records. I don't know that those will ever be made public, but we'll see. And to be clear, all this action here, while it itself is not a lawsuit, this is a precursor to a lawsuit. And those different items that you ran through, including RICO, including aiding and abetting, they want records, they want information and evidence that may result in them filing a lawsuit against Dr. Colker and Pete Wellness, but that has not happened yet.
Yes, and much like the AEW Zero Hour, the word RICO was what jumped out when Brandon was going through this, and he did get this following question in during the press conference that was held on Tuesday.
Pointing out that there may be RICO here, and I'm sure you don't want to raise any allegations that you're not yet ready to raise, but would it be plausible to take away that you're looking into whether Dr. Colker and his clinic supported a sex trafficking effort that involved Vince McMahon?
We don't know that, but we are seeking these records because we believe that there could be very serious allegations amended to our complaint. So that's what we're looking for. We don't have any metadata. We don't have any of the communications between Vince and Dr. Colker and employees of Peak Wellness. We don't have the substance of what was in these pills and infusions, the purpose of these pills and infusions, what involvement this attorney for Peak Wellness was in recommending her for the negotiation of the NDA. So it's really a global effort to get as much information as we can to get justice for Janelle.
And they are seeking 8 categories of records. They're looking for the electronic data, which Callis mentioned, including metadata, Dr. Colker and Peak Wellness's record keeping and billing procedures, payments related to Janelle Grant, Colker and Peak Wellness's payment arrangements with Vince McMahon and or WWE, the purpose of Ms. Grant's prescribed treatments, the substance of those prescribed treatments, communication between Colker and McMahon in relation to Janelle Grant, and Colker's involvement in recommending Ms. Grant's attorney for negotiation of the purported non-disclosure agreement.
Yeah, and what I was trying to get at in the question is RICO is an act that is advised to the mafia, for example. It took organized crime. And I think the natural conclusion that you would make is that they're looking at whether or not Dr. Kolker helped Vince McMahon in sex trafficking, supported, whether, I think what they're getting at here is she was being drugged by this doctor to, you know, keep her in a condition so that Vince could continue to abuse her. That seems to be what they're looking at there. It wasn't really a clear answer, but what other, you know, what other organized crime could they be looking at is what my question was getting at.
And, you know, as well, it's worth noting that over the summer, after this bill of discovery had been set out by Grant and her team, Vince McMahon had tried to argue that because the civil case is in the middle of a stay, that they should not be able to seek this, but that was turned down, and that argument was made by Vince McMahon's side, but did not lead to any action being taken. And of course, the stay, we have another almost 2 months left until the stay is uplifted December 11th.
Because that is a federal case at the federal level in federal court within the District of Connecticut. This is a separate case in state court in Connecticut. And the Vince and Kolker side were trying to raise that this is, you can't do this because the case that you're trying to get evidence for, and this would presumably help them get evidence to support their federal lawsuit. You can't make a request like this in the middle of a federal case that's in a stay. And the federal judge ruled that no, this does not, that it is okay what the Grant side is doing, and that it does not violate the stay.
So that is the latest on that filing. Was there anything else you took out? It's a very short press conference that they held, like under 15 minutes. They took a couple of questions, including Brandon's, and this was sort of just pushing forward this bill of discovery that we have known that they have been seeking out these medical records, and still they are not satisfied with what they have received thus far.
I think sort of the bigger takeaway is the Grant side really engaging with the public here. This was the second of this was another press call that they did a first press call back in September ahead of the Vince, was it September? Yeah. Ahead of the Vince documentary being released. So, I mean, this is not something that they had ever done before. I don't know what exactly the strategy is. I assume that they feel like this hasn't gotten the right attention or enough attention. So they're doing things like that. We did also hear from a second lawyer along with Ann Callis, Erica Nolan, and her name appears on some of the filings as well. So she's working on this case as well. And she had a number of comments, and those are all in the article on Post Wrestling.
All right. And that is the latest there on the Janelle Grant filing that we will continue to follow up on. And yes, we do have a story from Brandon up at Post Wrestling, and that does include the statement in full from Carlin Kolker and Peak Wellness's counsel, Frank Silvestri, who did get back to Brandon and stated that they have sent records. I guess the dispute is over the depth of the records, and if obviously Grant's side believes that they are withholding information.
Yeah, and they specify in that comment too, electronic records, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. The Grant's side says they've only got paper records, so there's a conflict there on what they're saying.
Somewhat adjacent to this case, we did hear from Kathy Colless, who is the now ex-wife of John Laurinaitis. She was on Nikki and Brie Bella's podcast today, and I did skim through it. Obviously did not go into any kind of details, but did confirm she is now divorced from John Laurinaitis. So that, I believe Brian Danielson had mentioned that she was going through a divorce, and now we at least heard directly from her that that she has gone through this. And also describing a medical procedure she had to have earlier this year. Of course, she's battled Bell's palsy in the past, and it just sounded like a horrific operation that she had to go through earlier this year. But that is the latest on that front, and did not expect.
And they live in Arizona, right?
Yes, I believe so.
But Laurinaitis lives in Florida, or at least his lawyers in Florida. I don't know.
Yeah, his lawyers are. We should double check on the whereabouts of one John Laurinaitis, who has kept a very very low profile outside of his Mr. Brennan, who has also gone quiet over the last couple of months.
Yeah, we'll have to catch up with that.
Following up on the Kevin Kelly Tate twins case, we did get a response from the defendants last week. AEW, Tony Khan, and Ian Riccoboni, that made the arguments that They believe that there was an improper venue that they were seeking, and they're looking to move this to the U.S. District Court for the Middle District of Florida in the Jacksonville division, and also believing that all of the talents in the lawsuit or in the on the roster were properly labeled as independent contractors, and this is their attempt to move things to Florida with the argument that only one of the defendants, that being Ian Riccoboni, is a resident of Pennsylvania, and we're dealing with a company that is based in Florida and all of these contracts that were executed in Florida on top of it.
Yes, all the talent. They said literally all the talent, a not controversial statement at all. They're all properly classified as independent contractors. That settles that. The plaintiff side does say otherwise. We've had Stephen New on here, and we discussed the defamation issue with him, and we had that conversation. You can listen back to where we learned a lot about the Seventh Amendment, among other things. I think, you know, it's pretty clear to me when you look at a multi-factor test that the federal government uses to determine whether or not a worker is an employee or an independent contractor. There's a number of control factors. There may be some AEW talent that might get by if this was put to a real legal test. It might get by. But I think most of them.
Are you saying it doesn't come down to exclusivity, Brandon?
It does not come down to exclusivity. How many times would you like me to say it? It comes down to a number of control factors. If you look at the federal government's definition, there's not one factor that is more important than any other factor. They're to be interpreted in a holistic way. And just given the permanence of the relationship, you have a long-term contract with this company. They tell you when you're booked. They tell you where to be. They tell you what call time is. They tell you who's going to go over the match. They tell you how long the match should be. They provide all of the materials except for maybe your ring gear. They tell you that, and I'm sure AEW has a number of policies that they expect talent to follow, and they may be good policies, but the more you put this kind of control on workers, the more you're contributing to a case that these people should be classified as employees and not contractors. Now, we'll probably, you know, the first thing that has to be dealt with in this case is whether, besides venue, besides whether this should be in state court in Philadelphia or whether this should be in federal court in Jacksonville. After that, they have made a motion to compel arbitration. So it's a question of, is a judge going to rule that the arbitration clauses in their talent contracts should be upheld and should be enforced. This is an issue that Stephen New has fought before in the case of the Kelly Klein lawsuit against Sinclair Broadcasting, the Ring of Honor. And the judge in that case, now that was a federal case in Maryland, they ruled that should go to arbitration. It did. So we don't know what happened there. And it could be the same thing might happen here. It preempts, again, the issue of contractor employee even being litigated.
And there is a section in the filing specific to Ian Riccoboni stating that he has a strong interest in having this case tried in the Middle District of Florida because of his
contract. And we got his contract too.
Yes, we well, I'll let you explain that. We kind of got his contract in the literal sense. Because of his contractual relationship and defense agreement with the defendant AEW and its counsel, if required to retain his own counsel against the plaintiffs defending against a class action case in federal court, defendant Riccoboni would incur significant and burdensome expenses. So there is a financial incentive for Ian Riccoboni to have this tried in Florida because of his contractual language. Tell us about all this contractual language we learned about in Ian Riccoboni's contract.
It's a lot of black bars. There's some more than 20 pages. We got his contract file as an exhibit. We can read the first paragraph where it says this is an agreement between All Elite Wrestling and Ian Riccoboni. And then we have 20 pages of black lines, black boxes across every single line, every word besides the signature block. We can see Tony Khan's signature. We can see a digital signature of Ian Riccoboni. And that is basically all we have. So, we still do not have in the public record an AEW talent contract. But we do have a number of talent contracts. It's something that I'm working on putting together. I put out a bunch of venue contracts for events for WNAW. I want to put together sort of the record of talent contracts that we do have. And we have a Ring of Honor contract because of the Kelly Klein lawsuit. We have some over the years. I'm sure they've changed, but over the years we have many WWE contracts. We don't have any that are really recent. But we still do not have any AEW contracts. And I think both sides in this case want those under seal.
All right. So there is your latest on independent contractors and whether or not they are they were properly or improperly.
And it's
labeled.
Notable that AW is defending Ian Riccoboni. They're on the same side of this lawsuit. And I'm sure they want to maintain a good relationship with them, and they don't want to have him incur any legal resources when, you know, certainly the AEW side is well-funded.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MCU Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. Tag us in a photo of yourself wearing our merch on social media, and I'll even send you a signed postcard while supplies last. That's chop-tees.com/postwrestling.
Let's chat. Let's move on over to Ring of Honor. There was unfortunate news this past week, the passing of Joe Koff. And before we bring in our guest, Brandon, did you have a lot of interactions with Joe Koff over the years?
I don't think any. Did you?
I had a lot of interactions actually with Joe Koff. I dealt with him quite a bit during, you know, the Sinclair years and such. He was someone that, I mean, as I can appreciate in years that have since gone, always responded, always got back to me, and that's something that I appreciate more so in hindsight than maybe I did at the time, but was also someone that 2011 is when Sinclair purchases Ring of Honor. And I mean, realistically, I think it's a safe assumption to say that if Joe Koff does not have the background that he did have involved with championship wrestling from Florida in the mid-80s and producing some of those Battle of the Belts specials.
I didn't even know that until I read your obituary, that he was involved in the Battle of the Belts specials. And I was like, especially like when all of this video got on YouTube and like you got to see like the 1986 Wyndham versus Flair Battle of the Belts match, that was like a big deal to me like 10 years ago when that stuff first started appearing. I didn't know that he was, very involved in that.
He brought that up all the time. He was very proud of those shows. And I mean, it was Gary Juster that ended up kind of being the go-between between Kerry Silken and Joe Koff. And I don't think if you didn't have a Joe Koff in that position in Sinclair, who is to say Ring of Honor would have been sold anywhere? Like Kerry Silken was ready to just divest himself of what had been a money losing operation for all the years that Silken ran it. And like, I don't know if Sinclair on its own would have been seeking out, wrestling programming, much less having somebody to oversee it that would have at least had a background in wrestling and truly like, you could hear in Joe Koff his, championing this brand and moving it forward. For the ups and downs that Ring of Honor had during its Sinclair era, it did have someone at the helm who at least believed in the product and was not just someone in Sinclair assigned to oversee the wrestling that had no idea what they were dealing with.
Yeah, and I think Kerry Silken had been open about Ring of Honor not really making money, and so I don't know if it ever really made money for Sinclair either, but so do you know the story is like how like Joe Koff was already working for Sinclair at the time, but
yes.
When they acquired Ring of Honor, and he just happened to have like a wrestling connection.
It's not like Gary Juster was, I would imagine like their history goes back to like the mid 80s. And anyway, it was a contact for Gary Juster, and he got the sides together and were able to, it sounds like Joe Koff like running this up the ladder, and it was, programming for Sinclair. But I think it was very much the key being that Joe Koff was somebody that had a knowledge of the product, had this contact in Gary Juster, and Kerry Silken was looking to get out. And that kept Ring of Honor going for another 11 years after Kerry Silken was divesting himself. But somebody that got to work with Joe Koff for a number of years, and he is a part of our post-wrestling network of hosts, Jordan Goodman, who is joining us now from South Florida, no less. On the road, Jordan.
Yes, sir. Good to see you guys. How you doing?
We're doing well. First of all, our condolences regarding Joe Koff. It was unfortunate news. He had been sick for some time. Can you just tell us, Jordan, your own introduction to Joe Koff and also the time frame of when you came on board in Ring of Honor?
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity to do so. When Sinclair acquired Ring of Honor 2011, soon thereafter, they started taping monthly TV tapings in the Baltimore area. I, as a wrestling fan, went to most of them. At that point, didn't really have a vision or even much of a realistic desire to be involved in any sort of way. But, you know, I paid attention to the cast of characters each month to get a sense of, oh, that person does this. And Joe was often front and center, continued to do that for his entire tenure at Ring of Honor, really being fan friendly, not in the sense that I ever got where there was ego involved of him wanting to represent the brand on TV. But he just wanted to shake hands and listen to fans. And I really admired that. Years later, 2016, coincidentally, I was in South Florida, about to fly home back to Baltimore, which is what I'm doing a couple hours from now today. And I was sick, like really fucking sick, like nauseous. And I was about to decide to switch my flight to the next day and go home. But then I saw Joe Koff in line to get on the same plane I was getting on. And at this point, I obviously was very familiar with who he was, even though he and I never formally met up until that point. So I get on the plane. He was already there, a couple rows in on the aisle. And my promise to myself was just to do what I did, which was introduce myself very briefly and say thank you to him for his contributions to pro wrestling. Because at that point, even in 2016, I thought his contributions were significant and positive. He was warm in his response, and then I had the audacity to ask if I could sit next to him. And respect to him, because like from his perspective, I'm just a wrestling fan who recognized him, and signing up to sit next to me could not have been the most pleasant 2.5 hours for him, potentially. I let him lead me in how deep he was willing to talk about his business. And for 2.5 hours, we spoke about his business in great detail. One of the things I loved most was the first thing he asked me, what can we do better? And to me, that was a green flag because it demonstrated openness, humility, and a desire to improve his product. What was so enjoyable about those 2.5 hours, in addition to talking about pro wrestling in meaningful ways, was that we also talked about music. I'm a musician. He was a music fan. He lived through the Beatles. Like, that was interesting to me. We both connected and talked about being Jewish and living in the Baltimore area. So by the end of that flight, he felt like a friend. He was warm. He was generous. And he just had a really like heart-centered spirit. He gave me his card. Within a week or so, I asked if he wanted to get lunch. I was blunt at the start of lunch. Hey, man, I'm contributing in some way. And I think he gave a really honest and thoughtful response, saying, I'm not saying no. I'm not saying yes right now. It's just a matter of time and fit. And then for the next hour, we had a great lunch talking about wrestling. For the next year plus, like, my greatest desire was to do something of significance with his company, but to earn it. Because I didn't want to ask a second time without feeling like I put myself in a position that was earned. So really for the next year plus, the way I was conducting my own business, I was trying to earn trust with him. I would purchase all his pay-per-views as I was doing previously. But after I'd watched the pay-per-views, obviously now I'm watching it with a different set of eyes. I would email him. Here's what I loved. Here's what I didn't love. And here's ways that I would potentially fix what I didn't love. Genuinely, guys, not only would he always respond to my emails, typically he would literally respond within minutes of my emails. Like, and this is, you know, 30 minutes after a live pay-per-view broadcast had just ended, where he's typically not at home and on the road. He's someone who cared about people. He paid attention, and he paid attention to me. Maybe 6 or 9 months into me initially meeting him, I was featured in a local publication, focusing on my drum and wellness related work. And I still remember it was a Saturday morning. I was setting up to do one of my weekly drum therapy groups, and I get an email from him, and he included an attachment of a picture he took of this magazine article of me. And he said something to the effect of, "Way to go. I'm proud of you, man." Like, dude paid attention. He cared. It wasn't so much about me contributing to his business, but I felt a genuine sense that he had a personal interest in who I was as a human being. Fast forward, this is now early 2017. I finally call him up. "Hey, man, I'm ready to contribute at a high level." He responds, says, "Come into my office. We'll chat." I gave him my pitch, and ultimately he was like, "I like you. It's not necessarily my call." He had a GM that he hired that was more day to day, on the business. Yes, Joe was the COO of Ring of Honor, but he had a VP role at Sinclair. Mm-hmm. So, he had a GM that was responsible for the day to day, business dealings of Ring of Honor. And essentially he told me, "Go sell him." But Joe gave me the opportunity to sell his GM, to give me the opportunity to live dozens of dreams that I was afforded. Joe was always fair in our business dealings. I negotiated, and I wanted to be able to maintain my other businesses and creative projects. And he was fair in negotiation. And I stayed for a handful of years. I left spring 2019. And even after the fact, I could sense that it was important to him that he and I were good. Because when you start as friends or whatever you define it, and then this man becomes my boss, it certainly changes the dynamic in certain ways. He still remained sweet and caring and interested. But it's different when someone's your boss and they're now paying you to deliver value on a daily basis. But something I really appreciated was even after I decided to leave this company, it seemed like he still cared about me no less. My father died a year ago. He reached out to me personally. And a few months later, we met for coffee. This is the last time I saw him in person. And that was really cathartic because it felt like he and I could start as friends and end as friends. And in the meantime, in between all that, we both got to live our dreams in concert together, and I'm forever grateful to him for all that.
He seemed, you know, in a lot of my interactions with him, it felt very similar. Like, he is somebody that, you know, grew up a fan. He had a history in pro wrestling, but I still think realized that, you know, he was around people, like, he was not getting into the nuts and bolts of the wrestling. He had people that were being delegated to do that, and sort of he understood that divide, and not becoming just overbearing or getting in over his own head when it came to the day-to-day wrestling operations, and understood that separation.
Yeah, which I think is wise for any operator. Like, hire people that know better than you, that have skills you don't have. And he really championed people. He was a wonderful brand ambassador for Ring of Honor, always talking about how proud he was of Ring of Honor and its staff. But even, you know, Delirious Hunter, who was head of creative for the entire run that I was there, like, he spoke so highly of Hunter. Greg, his GM, spoke so highly of Greg. And that matters, because culture starts at the top. And he was someone that bet on people and backed them and supported them and put trust and faith that he made good picks.
And how did you sense, like, you're coming in at such an interesting time period for the company, because it's going throughout the Sinclair era. It's trying to pick up traction, and you start to see that materialize in 2017 with the rise of the Elite. And I think a big moment was that Supercard of Honor show in New Orleans the year before the Madison Square Garden show, but a year prior in New Orleans, like that was a really strong attendance built off Kenny Omega and Cody Rhodes. And you're starting to see upticks in attendance and you're there on the ground floor kind of seeing this growth in business. I have to imagine that that was, you know, a pretty important time period for the company where they are seeing kind of this independent boom that is impacting them directly.
Yeah. Also the first time you and I met in person, John.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
That was one of the best trips of my life, even though it at times was very difficult. That was also the night that we launched Honor Club. And that wasn't as smooth as we would have hoped, technologically speaking. So it was work and at times it was intense and difficult work, but trip of my life. I love that city. And yeah, look, selfishly, I'll admit it. I rode the wave from 2017 to 2019 in that company. And so blessed, experience of a lifetime for a couple years for me.
You could have just come on here and said, you know what, look at the numbers from when I came on. I mean, you could have just taken all that credit for yourself, Jordan.
Oh, yes, because that's who I am naturally. But you know what, to that point though, like, I wish I did not hide as much in the shadows. And here's what I mean, John. The wrestling business is a tough fucking business. It is not friendly. It is often not fair. I am trained and work as a psychotherapist. In therapy and in doing this work, there are code of ethics that I must adhere to. Pro wrestling is the Wild West. And it was important for me to not be, to not come off as a mark, to be blunt. I don't have a picture with Joe. I just don't. And that crushes me now. I don't have some visual representation of my, time spent with him. I wish I allowed myself to show my face a bit more, not necessarily in front of the Ring of Honor camera, but even just with the people that I was working with. But to go back to your point, John, like, yeah, that was one of the peaks of the business. And then it continued on, I'd argue, to Madison Square Garden a year later. But New Orleans in particular, and I'm glad you mentioned it, as I think back to my time, yes, putting on a suit and getting to work a sold out Madison Square Garden was super fun and interesting and meaningful. But the year prior, they gave me the responsibility to essentially program and produce the Festival of Honor that we did for like the 6 or so hours prior to Supercard beginning. It for me as a work day, just the excitement of getting to wake up, and that's what I got to do with the time of my life that day in New Orleans. It was awesome. And there was obviously a palpable excitement amongst crew, amongst production, amongst office, amongst wrestlers, amongst fans, that something very special was happening with this company at that time.
Did you feel like there was the opportunity there for Ring of Honor that basically around that time, going into 2019, that AEW assumed? Was there an opportunity there really for Ring of Honor to do that? And was there the backing to go for that?
Absolutely. But easier said than done, for sure. And for what it's worth, it's not like we weren't doing things to help take Ring of Honor to the next level. Obviously, the what would have been so helpful was what AEW was able to do from the jump after their initial few shows, which is live weekly TV. It was tough. I mean, my responsibilities were in branding and communications. When you have a couple hundred markets airing your product, different time, different days over the weekend, like, that's tough to build community around. That's tough to have some sense of a destination appointment, not just viewing, but the cultural experience of people enjoying the product and talking about the product on social media and otherwise at the same time.
I remember Joe like talking in an interview at the time about trying to, or they wanted to eventually get to the point where in a lot of markets it was all the same time, so that there could be, you know, for example, people interacting on social media while they're all seeing it for the first time.
Yeah, and I don't think it's out of turn at this point for me to share. When we produced Ring of Honor, produced All In a handful of months later, they had a 0 hour special in WGN America. Mm-hmm. Like, that wasn't random. And I put in a lot of work to try to make something happen with that relationship. Even after I left, I had the sense that there was still plans to move towards something like that. Obviously, AEW crowded the marketplace, at that point. And then a global pandemic, made something like that perhaps near impossible.
Did you, like, you're right in the middle of things when All In happens. And I think that's such an interesting kind of headspace to get into for Joe Koff, where, you know, some of these key performers, their contracts are coming due, and, you know, this show becomes just, it just turns into what it does. It's this cultural event for pro wrestling fans is what it turns into. But I think the legacy of that show is that a lot of people probably do not realize to the extent that Ring of Honor was involved in the, you know, the behind the scenes of the show, and just the fact that they had the ability to hold the contractual rights to Cody and the Bucks in the US and even into some markets in Canada.
Yeah, and I could argue both ways,
yeah.
As I did back then. Look, for Ring of Honor to not have our, you know, literal brand stamp on the show, that helped preserve what was largely appealing about the Elite and being the Elite. That it was this DIY independent spirit and mentality that fans galvanized around. I'm a fan. Look, I didn't ask for a job because I needed a job. Like, I fucking love wrestling. I told Joe at that meeting in his office when I really pitched him, like, I want to play in your sandbox. Like, life is short, and this is something that I'm naturally energized about. And so to that point, Cody and the Bucks and Hangman and Kenny were really capturing that type of fan excitement. And yes, to have the Ring of Honor branding all over that show, that could have created the perception of, like, mommy and daddy are actually in charge and overseeing what's happening. So I certainly understand that by Ring of Honor having a more behind the scenes role, it was, there were advantages to that, quite frankly. And look, Ring of Honor, Sinclair, they still benefited financially, owning the rights to the event, ticket sales, et cetera. I don't know the details of how all that was broken down. But if the show succeeded, then Ring of Honor, from a business perspective, succeeded. I heard Joe on Busted Open about a month or so ago. And respect to Busted Open for offering Joe a platform to speak about his contributions to pro wrestling. I really appreciated that. And I believe Bully Ray asked, you know, any regrets about that. And to Joe's credit, he said no. Look, in hindsight, was it a mistake? Maybe. But hindsight is in the past. And at least personally, I'm glad that Joe was able to find peace in that. And, you know, ultimately it was his call, and it's really up to him to decide, like, if he was good with that or not.
I would be, you know, pretty confident in assuming, as a guy that had grown up in the Northeast and attending shows at the Garden, that was, you know, the promotional high point was the Madison Square Garden show. Did you get, you know, just a chance, like, whether it was weeks, months after that event, to reflect on that with him, and an achievement that, I mean, just the fact to get into Madison Square Garden that turned into its own thing, where at one point, like just going through the whole story yesterday of how they indicated they were running the date. They had to pull out of it. They get back into it. Like, it was just an achievement to get in the building, much less to fill it.
Yeah. From my understanding, no other promoter not named McMahon had run that building in something like 60 years.
Since 1960. Yeah.
Yeah. What an achievement. And it wasn't easy, to your point, of even getting the opportunity to do that. I was kept in the loop enough to know, something might be happening. Now it may not be as possible. And I'll never forget, like, that fall before of 2018, the only time I was asked to come into a room and the door was locked. It was like, hey, Jordan, the garden. We're announcing it at 5 p.m. today, from memory. Go figure it out. Meaning it was up to me and a graphic designer and web designer we had on staff to figure out how to introduce that to the world. One of those work days that certainly sticks out for me. And it, dude, like, how exciting. I felt a gut sense it would sell out. Now, obviously, the promotion of it was complicated, given that the Elite weren't guaranteed to still be under contract. So I had to be, let's say, ethical or to not promote something that we couldn't deliver on necessarily. But for me, it was this sense of it's happening. And that was my immediate response. And that became an initial hashtag that we ran with, just the idea that it's happening. And my gut told me it would do very well because it was a once in a lifetime event that me as a fan would want to experience live. And I trusted that we had enough fans that would feel the same way. In a sense, it felt like we were getting away with something that wasn't possible. And that was kind of true because no other wrestling promotion had been able to do that for over half a century. It was incredible.
And there was some pushback from WWE to try to prevent this from happening. Is that right?
To my understanding, and ROH, Joe, Sinclair, whomever pushed around, they fought back and obviously succeeded in that fight.
And I know this is kind of after your time there, but, you know, just in looking at, to me, a big part of the Sinclair legacy and whatever people's thoughts are on Sinclair as a company is that during the pandemic, you can certainly, like, we were very critical at the time of various companies that were just racing to tape their television. There were no protocols at the beginning that we're hearing out of the Performance Center and such. And here's Ring of Honor that is maybe being the most cautious, and you're hearing that everyone is getting paid throughout this time. And yet here's a company that took all these measures and was harmed as much as any company coming out of the pandemic, but took care of its talent throughout this whole period that they were extra cautious about before they got to empty arena shows. And I think that's just, it's unfortunate, but it's like with New Japan as well, another one that took great caution and coming out of it, like Ring of Honor never recovered from that period. And New Japan, you could argue, still feeling the effects of that period.
Yeah, but honestly, let that be a part of Joe's legacy and his contribution to pro wrestling. Again, in Jewish culture, we have a term called mensch. Brandon, you familiar with the mensch? The
mensch? Maybe you spell it. Is that M-E-N-S-C-H?
Yeah. Well done.
Okay.
So I looked up the term mensch. It's Yiddish, this morning, and a person of integrity and honor. So yes, true. But I think when I think of a menschy person, warmth and generosity, someone who cares about people, that's what comes to mind. That's who Joe was at his core. Again, not an easy business, not a kind business, not a fair business. So Joe had certainly the capacity to be tough when he needed to, but I don't think he would necessarily find the joy in that. He liked people. And he was an optimist. He he got to live his dreams. John, as you mentioned earlier, like, he was someone who grew up in the Northeast, attended shows at Madison Square Garden, and then all these decades later, found an opportunity to contribute to the business. And the peak of that, in large part, was him getting to bring his promotion to Madison Square Garden. Like, what a story. But yeah, to your point of the pandemic, yeah, I was not working there at that point. I could not imagine the terror of a global pandemic happening. You know, the company, a wrestling company, is the value is running events, live events, in front of thousands of people. And that's the product you put on TV. When that gets shut down, that is scary for a wrestler, no less scary for a video editor in the company. And to Joe's credit, from my understanding, everyone got paid. Every contract was honored. So credit to him for that.
Any closing thoughts, Jordan? Just, you know, I'm sure you've had some time over the last 24 hours just to reflect on Joe. I'm sure you've gone back to that last face-to-face meeting that you had with him. But, you know, I just look at him as somebody that, you know, and this would be, I guess, a question for Kerry Silken. Like, if Ring of Honor would have existed if there was not a Joe Koff in a position at a broadcaster like Sinclair, of what would have happened with the company? I don't think it's far-fetched to say that, like, that might have been the end of the road, and really does change history if you eliminate Ring of Honor from the national scene in 2011.
Yeah, from what I've read, multiple accounts in the past 24 hours of people even more familiar with the business than I, Joe may have saved Ring of Honor multiple times. Mm-hmm. You know, the state of the promotion is what it is right now, but it's still active. It's still alive. And Joe potentially could have sold it to someone or some entity that may not be as passionate as a Tony Khan seems to be about wrestling in general, and in particular Ring of Honor. And speaking just more broadly on Joe's legacy and contribution to pro wrestling, I mean, like, one of the difficulties I would think from Ring of Honor's perspective is that they kind of became this developmental territory for others, particularly WWE. Joe's Ring of Honor, that's where I saw El Generico and Kevin Steen live for the first time. And they move on, and you get Undisputed Era, the Adam Coles of the world really making their mark in Ring of Honor and then going to NXT. And then obviously this last class of Cody and the Bucks and Hangman Page and even SCU and Best Friends, all leaving at the same time to become the core talent of a new wrestling company that is thriving today from a financial perspective, at least. Like, Ring of Honor really was an opportunity, not just to people like me in the unique ways that I was able to contribute, but to the talent of pro wrestling. You look at a WrestleMania card, and it is full from the main event, literally, to the opening matches, with talent that got to hone their craft and got to literally stay in the wrestling business by having, be able to make a nice living. That's all thanks to the Ring of Honor that Joe was responsible for. And last thing that comes to mind, like, the partnerships, Billy Corgan's NWA greatly benefited from working with Joe directly. New Japan, we see the same playbook happening in AEW now with co-branded events and pay-per-views. CMLL as well. Joe was a really open and collaborative operator in the wrestling space. And I certainly felt that way with him as an employee of his as well.
Very well said. And we thank you very much, Jordan. Jordan has a flight to catch, so we've got to let him go. But you can always catch him monthly here on The Wellness Policy at postwrestling.com with our man Neil and Wei Ting. But thank you so much, Jordan, for taking some time to chat about Joe Koff. And again, our condolences.
Thank you. I appreciate you both. And I'll end with this. Look, death sucks. My dad died a bit more than a year ago, and to be quite frank, I've had the number of like father figures I've had in my life, I could count on one hand, and all of them have been because of who I married or who my parents grew up with. The one exception was Joe, a guy that was about my dad's age. And it's a relationship that I formed on my own with him. So in some ways he felt like a father figure in at certain times he was my boss. At most times he was my friend. I question my own sense of spirituality. I find comfort that he had a deep faith in his Jewish religion. But if some spiritual or energetic way in which he can hear me right now, I hope I did him proud, and I'll keep banging the drum for you, Joe.
Well, I hope when you get on that flight today and some aspiring fan comes up to you and asks to sit next to you, Jordan, that you will allow them to sit next to you.
Yeah, and maybe one day they'll have their own show on Post Wrestling.
There you go. Thank you so much, Jordan. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
All right. That was Jordan Goodman joining us as we discussed Ring of Honor. Did you go to that Madison Square Garden show, that WrestleMania weekend?
No, I've never been to Madison Square Garden for an actual event. I went inside Madison Square Garden. I was in New York City recently and just like wandered around until security looked at me funny, so I left.
Yes. You and I first met at All In, as I recall. That was our first meeting in 2018.
At the Starcast Hotel or something.
That is, yes.
We met each other there. Yeah.
Yes, I met you and one Chris Harrington. And then I also noticed not off into the distance too far was one super agent, Barry Bloom, just wandering about and then asking me what I thought about this whole thing. I was like,
really?
Why? You thinking of starting a company, Barry, or involved with anyone that might be starting a company? What's going on? So there you go. Little did we know. All right. We will close off with just a couple of quick notes. Everyone's favorite topic, ratings notes. What does it mean? Who's a draw? SmackDown was a draw on Friday night with 1,652,000 viewers. Number one on cable for the night with a 0.49 in the demo. And then Raw, our taped two-hour edition of Raw going up against Monday Night Football and the Major League Baseball playoffs, posting 1,539,000 viewers. Almost identical to last week's viewership, but a drop of 8% in the demo to a 0.44, our two key numbers over the last couple of nights.
The SmackDown number was up, wasn't it?
It was. Yes. This was their best number since the season premiere on USA. So a very good number.
Did it beat Fox, more importantly?
No. Fox dominated, through baseball. So the Fox SmackDown wars continue. The press release wars, the Fast National wars. That's the engagement. I think you need to get into football ratings as well. I think that should be your sub brand.
I've thought about some things lately. I won't disclose them here to the public quite yet, but yes. It's, that's a better number though than we've seen before. So maybe it's, you're getting a better idea of where it's going to normalize. I'm interested to see what the NXT rating is when it comes out, because that second week was so, so much similar to the premiere.
Just a quick note on WrestleDream. I'm not going to go through all your thoughts on, retirement angles and, bags over the head. But the show ended up drawing, just over 8,000 at the Tacoma Dome. By that's really under any, standard, like a very healthy number. And when you look at the pay-per-view numbers, Full Gear next month, just under 5,200 according to WrestleTix. It seems like the pay-per-views certainly are ones that, you're seeing better advances for, ones where I think people know what the product is, which has not been able to have the same kind of, long view that we see for these television numbers week to week, where I think it's more indicative of markets that are, whether it's unsure of what they're going to see on certain weeks products, but they are, you don't see the same trend as we do on the TV shows as we do for pay-per-view, where I think the audience has a lot more confidence in, regardless of what the card is or if nothing's announced, what you're getting for a four-hour pay-per-view.
It's the peak event, so they probably draw a little bit more from people out of town, or a lot more from people out of town versus TV. And I think, you know, people have probably also locally just feel like, you know, it's more missable if Collision or Dynamite come to town. But the pay-per-view and this last one is another iteration of people really review these strongly, and the fan reaction is really positive. So it's not something that people feel like they can miss. You can kind of tell a similar story maybe about the TV. And I would suggest, you know, what happens on the pay-per-view can not be meddled so much with writers and overly creative ideas. And you just have people having really excellent matches that are really well received. So it continues to be a strong product.
Yes. And this week they have, well, Dynamite is tonight. It's their debut in San Jose. They're running the SAP Center, which is the big arena in San Jose. And then tomorrow, they're taping Collision and Battle of the Belt. So we're getting a 3-hour block on Saturday night.
This is a Joe Koff tribute Battle of the Belt.
You know what? I seriously, like, Battle of the Belts, I would put a bunch of ROH alumni and make it the Joe Koff tribute Battle of the Belts. Like, I think, like, you have the talent that certainly has that history with Joe Koff. I mean, why not? I would, yeah, do something
it,
like that.
It seems like something, you know, that's calling back to history. It's something that the AEW and Tony Khan do often.
My one question I've had for you since the weekend. Had you flown to Tacoma, Washington, and you had your secondary screen experience throughout a 4-hour pay-per-view as you were watching the latest, well, I guess the WNBA season's over. You'd be watching some kind of sports.
No, it's not. The finals are on right now.
Okay, I'm out of the loop. Okay, but you wait. Playoffs. You sit through, you do all this travel. You're there for your one question for Tony Khan, and Tony Khan doesn't appear at the press conference. Is that a line in the sand for you when it comes to traveling for these AEW events?
Probably. Yeah, I would be not happy. But, you know, I did not for a second consider going to the show, so it's sort of a moot point. But yeah, I mean, this was a fairly short one, right? And I know there was the hullabaloo about nobody asking Ryan any more questions, but I'm there. I'm interested as both from like a viewer's perspective, an audience member perspective, and a media member perspective. I'm interested in what, at a minimum, what people have to say out of character. If you want to do promos and stuff, then shoot a promo. If you want, you know, I don't think we should be expected to interact with people to help them create content. But yeah, it would be disappointing to not be able to ask questions to one of the most powerful people in the wrestling industry.
Yeah, that was just my thought, was just like, this is just, you know, just the latest example of kind of explaining like what kind of just like, let's just decide what these are supposed to be. I think it's frustrating for everybody. I don't like rehashing the whole press conference debate that I feel that we do monthly with these. My prediction for 2025 is that the WWE ones go away and the AEW ones, I will say at least, will be much shorter. That's my prediction. Okay. I think these are going to be contained, and I don't see Tony Khan removing himself from these. I think he really loves doing them, and I think Paul Levesque really hates doing them, and that's the key difference.
Yeah, I mean, like the media calls are another story too. Like I would see, you know, at least we do, you know, we can say, well, he didn't show up to the press conference, and I assume it's because he had to go catch a flight to go to the Jacksonville Jaguars game in London. But he's continuing to do the media press calls. And I would think that those would be the last to go away. And then despite the fact that he's not at the press conference in person, he's still doing these media calls before every single pay-per-view. Now whether you get called on or not, I haven't been called on in a while. I don't think you have been called on in a while either, John. I don't know if you've been putting your hand up though, but I have. But I'm still listening to them. And it's a good thing that they continue to do it, you know, for the sake of our interest in transparency.
We have a super chat here from Dr. Funtimes. Sends in a super chat. Thank you. I was wondering if there was a site fee for Survivor Series in Vancouver. Also, if there's any update for AEW rights in Canada. Will Sportsnet want it? Believe me, I have been trying to get to information. This is like cracking the Da Vinci Code when it comes to the Canadian rights for AEW. My impression is that they are, like, the deal was first signed in October of 2019. You know, we are well into October of 2024. The reason he brings up Sportsnet is because as of January 1st, all of WWE's content moves to Netflix in Canada. Sportsnet 360, they do air UFC content. I don't think that would get in the way of putting AEW on it, but I think it's a benefit to AEW that you have a network that has a history with wrestling that I don't think would have any aversion to seeking out AEW content. And you look at the UFC rights, they bounced back and forth. They were on Sportsnet, they went to TSN, now they're back at Sportsnet. I could see AEW having interest from Sportsnet. And we just saw with the Fox Sports Mexico deal of an example of WWE programming moving to Netflix soon, and they have now put AEW programming on.
We don't know when the Canadian deal for AEW expires.
We don't know the expiration.
No. It could have been renewed one time for all we know by now, because you're saying it started when Dynamite started, right?
Yeah, I feel there was a renewal.
Okay.
There was a renewal in there somewhere, and I don't think there's anything like immediate, but I still have to verify that.
Yeah, and for, is there a site fee for Vancouver?
The press release lists Destination Vancouver. TKO
is more involved.
Yes. So, I mean, at the very least, probably some incentives for going to Vancouver.
But that tourism organization, I've looked into it, is a private entity, so not subject to public records request. But you know who is subject to public records request?
Oh, tell us.
The city of Tacoma.
Ah, oh boy.
So. And they control the Tacoma Dome, so which is where Wrestle Dream happened. So they may be required by law to respond to my records request. So hopefully we'll learn something about Wrestle Dream.
You think they would have learned after the Greensboro Coliseum booking these venues with Brandon Thurston in mind?
Yeah, they have to be careful where governments are involved. There's the people have a right to know. So we'll see what we can learn.
We're going to wrap things up, but thanks to everyone for tuning in, as well as Jordan Goodman for joining us. Next week on the show, the returning Kareem Zidane is going to be on the program with us. We're going to talk about a new audio series that he is doing, and we'll also be talking about, well, first of all, this weekend, PFL is going to be in Saudi Arabia with Francis Ngannou fighting. This is the Battle of Giants pay-per-view. And then WWE is going back to Saudi Arabia in just a couple of weeks. So we will be discussing Saudi Arabia with Kareem Zidane, who is always we've had him on multiple times.
And Turki Alsheik, who was you know, a guy who's been on the W shows from the moment that Brock Braun Strowman won the Greatest Royal Rumble. He's the guy there handing Braun Strowman the belt in 2018.
I did not realize that. I didn't know that was him.
Oh, I'm pretty sure. Check the tape, but I'm pretty sure that's him. So he's been, you know, the person in charge of the General Entertainment Authority or Drum Sports Authority, whatever it's been over these years. I feel like he's really emerging as somebody whose name is getting recognized, whose face is getting associated with this push to make Saudi Arabia this center of combat sports. And you even got most recently Triple H interacting with him on Twitter, quote tweeting and promoting Crown Jewel.
ESPN just put out a list of influencers in combat sports. He was listed number one, if I'm not mistaken. I think he is a figure that everyone should, in the combat sports world, should be focused on, because he has his hands in boxing, in MMA, and professional wrestling. And
and playing FIFA video games too.
Of course. Yes. You know, you have to balance all of this stuff out with some downtime.
If you're going to play FIFA with him, make sure you bring a couple TVs with you.
Yes. Yeah.
Need a backup.
And, you know, I'm sure adding his two cents about the design of championship belts.
Are
those the ugliest title belts you've ever seen? And you've worked on many an independent card. These have to be the ugliest championship belts I've ever seen.
I do not have opinions about the aesthetics of title belts. I realize that is an issue of interest for some people. But I do feel like they have some creative input, you know, or they have ideas that they want to see fulfilled. I know there's always like that rumor about them wanting Yokozuna on the Greatest Royal Rumble, even though Yokozuna had been dead for years. But I feel like there's probably at least an urgency to create something that's not just a standard pay-per-view. Clearly, I mean, you've seen it with the King of the Ring and Queen of the Ring models, and now with this, you know, champion versus champion.
All that and more coming up next week. So subscribe to the WrestleNomics and Post Wrestling YouTube channels, and you can check us out postwrestlingcafe.com tomorrow. Wei Ting and I will be doing a Rewind Away covering Saturday night's main event from October of 1987. Its own night of champions with three big title matches, including Sika going for the WWF championship.
The first one?
This was several years in. This was the 12th edition of Saturday Night's Main Event. The mega powers coming together on NBC programming. Meanwhile, you can subscribe patreon.com/WrestleNomics, and you can send in your questions to Brandon, which he takes each and every Sunday and gives you great analysis, great thought to all of your questions. Even if you want to send a question in about Brandon ranking the 10 ugliest looking championship belts, he will do so on the WrestleNomics feed.
I don't know about that, but we have an email forwarding address you can send to now, mailbag@WrestleNomics.com. Now, if you want to send me a nasty letter, you send that to Brandon at WrestleNomics.com. But if you want a question for the podcast, it's mailbag@WrestleNomics.com.
Yeah, tweet us your hatred. That's where I prefer to send everything, where I go through each and every mention that is sent my way. So thanks everyone for joining us. We're back Wednesdays, 1 p.m. Eastern time. We'll speak with Kareem Zidane next week. And a thank you again to Jordan Goodman for joining us. That concludes Pollock and Thurston.